Welcome to the Occupational Safety Leadership Podcast, episode number 127, with repeat guest Brian Haywood. So Brian was also on episode number 122, where we talked about the differences between the permit required and the non-permit required confined spaces out there. Today, I think I'd like to talk about atmospheric monitoring with Brian. But before we get started, Brian, if you could just do just a little bit of background about yourself, and then we'll just get right into it.
Sure. Thank you, David. So been in occupational safety and health and emergency response for about 33 years, going on 34 years, and grew up in the petrochem industry, high risk type of industries, and then been consulting for the last 18 years. And high risk environments, power plants, chemical plants, refineries, process safety type facilities, where, confined spaces become one of my favorite topics to talk about.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Thank you. So, speaking about today and the atmospheric, speaking about the atmospheric monitoring, what really got me thinking about it was right at the end of 122, we kind of briefly brushed over just how these instruments are going to be calibrated. And when you find that LEL, and really how you go back and actually determine the LEL, I know that we look at the meter and we like to think that meter is what the meter says, but that doesn't always equate. Could you kind of give us a couple practical examples in your experience?
Sure. So as we were talking about reclassifying spaces in the last session, we got into the atmospheric. There's two things before I get too far into it that that are just paramount in the monitoring of a hazardous atmosphere within a confined space or permit required confined space, and that is proper calibration of your meter per the manufacturer's frequency and procedures. And the next one that most people, I think we've come a long ways in this category, but we still find the majority of companies are not bump testing their meters before their daily use. And most manufacturers today have really nice little stations that they'll, if you buy a bunch of meters, they'll give you these bump test and charging stations. And it's simple as just push a button and the meter goes through a bump test. And it's basically taking the calibration gas and you're comparing the meter readings to the calibration percentages on the label on the Calgas. And, if it says it should be 19.7 oxygen, then that's what the oxygen should be reading. And it's a very simple, probably 2-3 minute test. But that verifies that the meter is actually functioning properly. Then the next failure mode is the user interface with the meter. And that's where, we get into these discussions. When I do a confined space entry course for entry supervisors, it's a full 8-hour course. And almost 3 hours of it is atmospheric hazards and using the meter and learning the limitations of the meter. There's people out there, whenever you ask the question in a training class and you say, how much oxygen is in the air right now? You will almost inevitably get the answer 100%.
Right.
Yep. And then you start looking at them, you sort of tilt your head and they're like, that's not right. And I'm like, well, you're in 100% volume of air, but this 100% volume of air is made up of 78% nitrogen. And they're like, what? Nitro? I thought nitrogen kills people. And I'm like, no, nitrogen's an inert gas. What nitrogen does is it's as simple as fixing. It just displaces the oxygen. And that's that 21%. Really, it's about 20.8 at sea level, but I like to round up to 21. So, it's 21% oxygen. And then I tell them this little factor that we use in parts per million and do a lot of in an IH is 1% of the atmosphere is equal to 10,000 parts per million. So, we're at 20.8. If you drop down to 19.8, you've lost 1% of the volume of oxygen in that volume of air. And that means you could have 10,000 parts per million of an unknown chemical inside the space. And if that chemical isn't one of the sensors that's on your four or five gas meter, you're never going to know it, especially if it doesn't have an odor threshold or it's not creating an atmosphere that can be seen, like condensing moisture, making a cloud down there. And so, when people sit there and go, well, the permit says 19.5 for oxygen. And if my meter's reading 19.6, hey, 19.6 is better than 19.5. So hop on in there, boys.
Yeah, that's right. that's
right. And, so not understanding how an atmosphere works that, I tell everybody, it's like, we don't enter these things in a vacuum. They're at atmospheric pressure and it's 100% volume of air. And, if you've lost 1% of oxygen in that space, you really, really should not be putting people in there. And so, as I was alluding to last time, I think it was when you and I were talking, we never use the OSHA ranges in our programs. Our program was basically, 20% to 21% for oxygen. And we'll get to LEL in a minute, but we used 2% to 3% for LEL. Mm-hmm, we didn't use the 19.5 to 23.5. And it wasn't that we wouldn't enter the space. The entry supervisors, who were typically the units or department supervisors, they just weren't qualified to write the permit for that type of atmosphere. And, this is way back in the day when you would have a big facility, you'd have 7, 10, up to 15 safety people on site. And those people would go be the entry supervisor for those type of atmospheres because it's just higher risk.
Right.
So let's try to train a frontline supervisor who doesn't understand, industrial hygiene terms and parts per million and percentages. We just left it. If it was between 20 and 21, you could write the permit. If it was less than 3 LEL, you could write the permit. But anything outside those ranges, even though it may have been acceptable to OSHA, we didn't let the frontline supervisor write that permit. So understanding, how an atmosphere works, that it's 100% volume of air in there, and you want 21% of it to be oxygen and, 0% to be LEL, that is your perfect atmosphere. So that covers the oxygen side of it. And rarely will you get an oxygen-enriched atmosphere, but you can. Oxidizers actually react and they create pure oxygen. So if you didn't have a perfectly clean space and that space had oxidizers in it and there was water or something causing that reaction, you could get an increase in oxygen. Or you could have a leak on your oxygen acetylene torch inside the space. And that would be putting pure oxygen. So, but most time, the number one killer in confined spaces is oxygen deficient atmosphere. So that's what we spend most of our time talking about. The next one, the LEL, this is one that just, I think I told you last time, I'd probably spent 5-6 years working in the industry. Was pretty confident that I understood confined spaces, had been a rescuer when I was in the fire department and was big into all the technical stuff. And I can remember we bought new meters from, not to endorse Mine Safety Appliances, but MSA was sort of the brand I grew up on. And we bought a whole bunch of these meters. And so they said, well, we'll provide you free training. And so, here's the sales guy or the technical engineer standing up telling us about this correction calculation in the back of their owner's manual. And almost every one of these meters, combustible gas indicators, will have these limitations on an LEL meter. And I like to say the meter is stupid. Okay. The meter doesn't know what flammable gas we're trying to measure for. Right. And for these type meters to work, we have to know the flammable that's in there. Right. It's not going to tell us what the flammable is. It's not a photoionization detector that's going to tell you what the gas is. It's you have to know. And, in some facilities, because the vessel processed propane or some kind of flammable liquid. And so you have an idea of, what could be the flammable vapor or gas that's in there. But even when you know it and you get the reading, almost all the big brands will have a table in the back of their owner's manual. And that table will be two columns. And then down the left-hand side are all the other flammable liquids or gases, or I should say vapors or gases. Mm-hmm. And if your calibration gas was methane, you use the methane column. If your calibration gas was pentane, then you would use the pentane column. So let's say you're going into a space that has a xylene, and you know your meter is reading 3%, right? And mm-hmm. you have sampled. If I don't know if I have time to get into this, but you know, you always sample top, middle, bottom, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. Gases will stratify. Some are lighter than air. Some are buoyant. Some are heavier than air. So you get a reading on your meter. Xylene is heavier than air, so it's going to be at the bottom. And the meter says it's 3%. Well, most people will literally look at the permit and go, oh, wow, if it's less than 10%, I'm okay. Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, go ahead, hop in there. Well, you go look at the correction calculation for xylene, and every company is a little bit different. Right. I haven't figured this out, but you know, Industrial Scientific's correction calculations will be a little different than MSA's. They're not too far off, but they're never the exact, because some of these get down to like, you know, decimal points of, you know, what you multiply by. Mm-hmm. And you look and you go, oh, you know, I have to multiply my correction calculation for xylene using methane as my correction calculation. And I don't know if this number is right. I'm just giving you a number to get you over 10. Say it's 3.5. Well, now you multiply 3 times 3.5. Now you're over 10. So now you're entering a hazardous atmosphere. And a lot of companies don't allow you to do that. But people think they're only entering 3%. They Yep. do not understand the correction. And I call it a correction calculation. Other companies call them different things. But it's basically the meter doesn't know that it's sampling xylene. And so it's just basically reading that gas, trying to get it to burn and create a pressure. And then the pressure is converted over to a percent LEL, but it's stupid. It doesn't know it's xylene or toluene or acetone or propane or whatever the flammable is. You have to know that. And then you have to know what your meter is being calibrated with. Is it pentane or methane? Look at the right table and then calculate. So instead of having, when I was at Great Lakes Chemical in the mid 90s, we actually made little laminated cards that we basically cut and pasted the MSA table and put it on a piece of paper and laminated and made it front and back. And so a supervisor could pull that out of their wallet, and knowing they're going into a xylene atmosphere, they knew what to multiply it by. And my plant manager, who came from Monsanto and was just a phenomenal safety leader from all rights as a plant manager, he basically said, well, this is ridiculous, right? He goes, why are you trying to satisfy OSHA? If you're worried about the supervisors making this critical mistake, just lower the concentration. You know, OSHA says it's 10. Why can't we use 3? Right, and I'm like, right. Well, I guess we can. He goes, if you make it 3 and train everybody and put it on the permit, right? And you tell that supervisor, hey, if that meter is reading over 3, you can't issue the permit. You have to call me or one of the safety engineers from the group. And we will come out and issue the permit. And that's where I learned that little trick. And ever since then, every one of my, you know, VPP sites, we always used ranges much narrower than what OSHA allowed. And it was all because of the limitation of the meter and people not understanding, you know, the true hazards of the atmosphere. And the last thing I'll say is it, you know, if you're at 9%, 9% is 90,000 parts per million of right. something, right?
Of and something.
Yeah. And you start looking at, well, gee, what chemicals do we have here on site that would be making my LEL meter go up to 9%? And that I'm not exceeding a permissible exposure limit or a threshold limit value, or God forbid, an IDLH at that level, right? Mm-hmm. So we look at flammable vapor and gases as the primary hazard being, it's explosive. We tend to lose sight of the chronic impact. And if you have that much flammable vapor inside the space, you're probably displacing a little bit of oxygen,
right?
Because that's a lot. People, most entry supervisors that are not safety professionals tend to struggle with understanding the ins and outs of atmospheric monitoring for confined spaces. So that's why I plug every chance I get is change your oxygen to 20 to 21%, change your LEL to, 2% or 3% or less. And you get rid of all these opportunities for someone to make a critical mistake, and let the people who do this for a living and live and breathe this stuff and read everything we can get our hands on about understanding this stuff, let us be the decision maker through some type of risk assessment before we allow somebody to crawl inside that space.
That is a fantastic, fantastic practice, Brian. I can think of when I was working for a company that did a lot of sewer work. We specifically had the meters calibrated for methane, of course, and all that stuff. So we didn't worry about a correction factor because we knew that we were finding methane, And oh, yeah. I think probably the highest was like 1 or 2%. And I'm still trying to find folks from that company to really go back and make sure that my memory is not foggy, But we would do everything that we could up front to ventilate the space too. And not just show up and say, well, whatever the atmosphere is, the atmosphere is, luckily, because we were working on multiple sewers, you could open up a lot of the sewer lids and really pull a lot of air through there. And that really helped out a lot. So I don't know what it would have been truly been if we had not done that and just kind of shown up and then taken a sample then. So it probably would have been higher, of course.
Yep. The other thing I'll tell you, real quick, is we see people ventilating spaces that, you've got a blower out there that's, 100 CFM trying to ventilate a 400,000 gallons, bulk storage tank.
Right.
And 3 weeks later, you'll be out of there during a turnaround. You'll see them having that same blower on a vessel that's, 500 gallons. There's a NFPA guide. I don't think they call it a standard. I think it's called a guide. So I want to be accurate in my terminology, but it's NFPA 350. NFPA 350 has taken what I call the slide rule of ventilation. And it's this neat little tool that basically says, okay, if you want 4 air exchanges, right, every hour or, whatever your rate is, I think they base it on 5 every hour, but basically you're getting an air change every 15 minutes. And it'll tell you the cubic size of the space, and it'll tell you what size blower you have to have.
Oh,
and then,
good.
If you only had a 1000 CFM blower, but you wanted to try to, ventilate a 70,000 cubic foot space, then you use that blower, you're only going to get so many air exchanges per hour based on what the blower can blow in there and how big the space is. It's a really real, I used one that was from NIOSH from, oh my gosh, it had to have been in the early 70s because it was almost like hand drawn with a ruler.
right.
That's how old it was. But, nothing's changed. The math has not changed, right? So NFPA took it and sort of modernized it. So, if your listeners are NFPA members, it's an appendices into one of the, it's an NFPA 350, and it is a heck of a tool to help people understand. Hey, if I've got a hazardous atmosphere, I just don't set a blower up and blow air in. And you always use forced air. That's positive pressure. That's
right.
3 times more effective than negative. But how much air do I need to blow in to that size space to actually get an air turnover that, I'm just not doing it for, to make it look good, I'm actually ventilating the space. So people should be using a tool like that tool in NFPA 350 to ensure that their blower is sized properly for the space. So, and again,
Fantastic.
we spend an hour just on ventilating a space. So, yeah, what's forced air ventilation? Where do you blow the air in? Where does the bad air come out? You know, don't fight Mother Nature. Make sure you got enough flow. Make sure you're getting fresh air from a source. You know, short circuiting, you're going into a horizontal tank. You got two manways on top open. You got the blower sitting next to one. You're blowing fresh air in the other. And well, the bad air is coming out right there where the blower's at. So you're sucking the bad air back into the blower, back into the space. So you're basically just recirculating the bad air. You know, there's a lot of science to it. And I'm always amazed, as I'm sure you are, when somebody says, yeah, we do confined space training, and they sit you down at a computer for 20 minutes to watch a video, and it's computer-based, and it doesn't train the supervisor on ventilation, LEL, oxygen. Doesn't train. It just basically covers the 1910-146 standard. I'm like, you know, that's why our training is 8 hours for an entry supervisor, right? Is they're going to go through the basic confined space, they're going to go through the entrant, the attendant, and then the entry supervisor training, which is the last 4 hours. And that last 4 hours is atmospheric monitoring, and ventilation, and rescue, which we'll talk about rescue in the next episode.
Well, I think that if you were going to do computer-based, it's super awesome just to kind of get a little bit of the classroom done, but you really got to do hands-on. So I am a perfect example of somebody who can pass any test and has zero experience, you know? So you always have to do that hands-on stuff then. So, hey, so we're getting really close on time. But before that we go, I'd like to go back to when you were talking about sampling of the air and all that good stuff. You know, it makes a strata and everything then. So, how does a person get their meter or their tube or something down to the bottom and then kind of factor in that
The pump speed and volume.
speed? Yes, exactly. I've watched a couple of folks just thrown a tube in, like, yep, it's good. And I'm like, no, it hasn't even made it to the meter yet, you know?
And how long do you wait for the meter to actually register? So my rule of thumb is, and it doesn't matter what your meter is, and most meters will max length of hose will be 20 foot hose. Some will even be max will be 15. But 5 minutes at each location. And I always ask them a trick, not to give one away of my training tricks to your listeners, but so I'll tell them, I said, okay, now it took 5 minutes when the space is 20 foot deep. It took 5 minutes for the gas to get from the bottom of the space through the 20 foot of tube to the meter to get a reading. And then you pull the tube up halfway, right? How long is it going to take for you to register that gas? Because there's a different gas at midway. How long is it going to take for the meter to register that? And almost everybody will go, well, if it was 5 minutes at the bottom and I pull my tube up halfway, oh, 2.5 minutes. And I'm like, no, because it's still going through a 20 foot of tube. It's still traveling the same distance. It's just you're measuring it. And so those assumptions that people make that are wrong are critical in your monitoring a space. We're talking about ventilation. I see people because they don't want to carry the blower upstairs. They'll set the blower up on the first floor and blow fresh air into the bottom of the reactor, and the vapor in the reactor is 2.5 times heavier than air. They think that they're going to blow it up and blow it out the top, right? I'm like, no, don't fight Mother Nature, right? If the gas is heavier, blow in from the top and let it go out the bottom, but know where it's going because you're taking a hazard, excuse me, a hazardous gas, and you're blowing it out into a process area. You may want to hook up ductwork to the bottom of your vessel and duct that material out to a safe location because you don't want to gas everybody working on the first floor. But yeah, the response time, the pull on the pump, all of that comes into play to getting a good sample. But I basically, you get into some of these tall storage columns that are 70, 80 foot tall. That's a little trickier. You need to do an assessment with your manufacturer. There was a great thing that I posted from the UK's HS&E, and it was a fatality investigation they did where the company was using just some regular plastic tubing. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the manufacturer's, and that tubing had degraded. And as it was degrading, it was causing the meters to have erroneous readings.
Yes. I've heard that same thing. Yes.
Yeah. And they did a really nice job. And I posted that on its Safety Engine on LinkedIn and my Facebook group and all that. But I mean, you know, like I said, we've been doing this 30 plus years, and I was like, wow, never thought of that happening. Right. Mm-hmm, So their big learning thing was, if the manufacturer gives you this spec for tubing, this length, this diameter, and that's what's supposed to go with that pump, you need to stick with that, because you start making changes and a little change here, a little change there, little bit here and there could give you erroneous readings, and that could lead to a disastrous result.
Oh, yeah. I know that I always bought the tube with the pump because I was always concerned that at some point that if I bought the pump only, I'd have to figure out the whole tube and who's going to carry it and how do you know it's on the truck and all that. So I was like, nope, it's all one kit. You know, yeah. I bought it. It's all in one spot.
You know? Yeah. And last thing I'll tell you is make sure you have that water filter on there, because, boy, you get that tube to the bottom and you suck water up into your meter, that's, $5,000, $7,000 gone. So,
yes.
That little water trap is can be a lifesaver to your meter.
Yes, I did go out on a site, and luckily we could kind of see the water coming up, and the guy's like, well, how can this be? I'm like, well, you cut it in the water. So luckily you could literally see it coming up, and we were able to stop it in time. But like the meter had some weird vacuum on it too. Like it didn't really read the oxygen right. It didn't. So right from the get go, you knew something was up.
Because it's not getting any gases to measure across there, because it's all, the hose is full of water.
Right.
So.
So, hey, Brian, we are bumping up on time. If you could spend just a couple of seconds and tell folks where they can find you, connect, and all that good stuff.
Sure. Find me on LinkedIn under my name, Brian Haywood, spelled with a Y. I have a LinkedIn group. My company's name is Safety Engineering, but it's the acronym is SAFTENG. All capital letters. And then, of course, that's my website, safteng.net is my website. So if people like talking, we have a pretty narrow band in the group. We talk a lot of safety management. We also talk a lot of hazardous materials, code standards. But most of it's, what I grew up in, chemical hazardous material type stuff. Join the Facebook group, Safety and Facebook group, or LinkedIn group, or connect with me on LinkedIn. Or you can always reach me through my website, through text, email, or phone call.
Fantastic, Brian. Thank you so much for joining us today. So episode number 127 is complete. Thank you so much for Brian, for joining us. And you'll be back on in future episodes also. So episode 127 is complete. Thank you so much for joining me, and have a safe day.